Monster Man, Episode 107, Hellcat to Hook Horror. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're beginning our journey through the H chapter of The Fiend Folio, the 1981 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And we're going to take a look at three monsters from that chapter, the Hellcat, the Horfox, and the Hook Horror. And we're going to take a little behind-the-scenes look and try to reconstruct some of the reasons that some of these monsters were created. Let's get started with the Hellcat. This monster was created by David Taylor. It is a Fiend Factory monster. That is, it originally appeared in the Fiend Factory column in White Dwarf magazine, where it was called the Warlock Cat. This is your basic devil in cat form. It is a, you know, familiar to evil magic users, and it is thematically, but not mechanically, similar to the Guardian Familiar, which we talked about last episode. It is the size of a tiger, which is pretty substantial, I guess. I mean, it's basically a hellhound, but a cat, which is, you know, in keeping with the style of a lot of your evil magic user types. I think maybe it could be smaller, but what do I know? It has a couple of really good bits. I think it's really, really thought about this thing as a piece in a campaign rather than an opponent for a fight. So, first up, it has one really fun idea, which is that it is invisible in the light, but in the dark, its glowing fiery bits can be seen. That's really cool. And it's the kind of, like, opposite of something that should happen in nature, which gives you a good, eerie, supernatural feel to a monster. Additionally, although the Hellcat is a familiar, it's not what you would call loyal, which makes sense, since it's evil, and it likes to be the servant of the most powerful evil character it can find. So if there is a more evil person in your party and you come up against an evil magic user with a Hellcat, the Hellcat will just abandon its former master and come work for you. It also won't fight parties that have evil characters in them. It'll just avoid them because, you know, it's not there to get involved in squabbles between characters who it thinks of as being on its team. Which makes sense because a devil is more associated with the idea of spiritual evil. You know, most evil characters will attack other evil characters because, you know, they're evil. They don't care that you're on their side. If they cared about, you know, sparing people, they'd be good. You know, unless you're on their side in terms of like politics, if you're part of their army, or you might help them out. But that's typically also true of good characters. So being evil seldom gives you any obvious benefits, whereas if you're good, often other good characters will recognize that and be willing to help you out, since being willing to help people out is a good trait. So it's a little interesting to see some camaraderie among the only people who are really devoted ideologically to being evil, which is devils. Of course, it's not free having this little guy on your side. It's not little at all, actually. It's not free having the Hellcat on your side. You've got to sacrifice a human being a week to it. And it was a day in the Fiend Factory version, which is crazy. So it's got a pretty high cost. But still, yeah, this is a pretty good monster. It's got a great visual gimmick. It doesn't quite react like you would think a magician's pet bite monster would. Yeah, strong. Then we have the Horfox, created by Graham Morris. The Horfox is an example of a monster of a type that I've mentioned before, which is that there's nothing wrong with it individually, right? If you just had the description of the Horfox, you'd be like, oh, this is pretty cool. But the problem with it is when you put it in the context of the overall D&D monster canon. I don't like that word, but you know what I mean. So the Horfox is like a fox, but it has a distinct colored pelt, and it has a cold attack. So it's like the Winter Wolf and the Yeti and the Frostman. It's another cold weather monster with like white fur and a cold attack. Oh, you could put all these in a, you know, kind of a cold weather environment that your players would be exploring, and it would be really repetitive. It really makes you appreciate the Remorhas, the Remorhas, the Remorhaze, the big centipede guy, because at least that's a cold monster that has a heat attack. And someone thought, hey, you know, a monster that lived in a really cold environment, it being able to heat itself would be really useful, right? And there's not that there's anything wrong with any one of these, but just like after a while, how many cold monsters are you going to fight going to the top of this mountain? You want a little variety, you know? Now, the Horfox does have a fun additional gimmick, which is, you know, something that I always look for in a monster, which is to say that because it's a cold monster, sure, it's vulnerable to fire. But the reason that people want to go hunt the Horfox is not aggressive, particularly. It says there's only a 10% chance that it'll fight you. I mean, it's like a fox. You know, foxes aren't aggressive. They run away. They're good at running away. They're running and hiding. You know, unless you are its prey, which you're way too big to be. But people want those beautiful silver gray pelts. So the way to kill a Horfox is with fire. But of course, if you do that, you destroy the value of its pelt. So if you're playing some game where you're like fur trappers, then the Horfox is a fun challenge for you to try and find a way to catch it without harming the value of its pet. But are you playing a game where you're fur trappers? I mean, it's kind of a fun background for a character, right? I mean, not actually trapping animals for their pelts, but it's sort of a loner mountain man archetype, isn't it? I mean, paddling up and down the Great Lakes in your canoe sort of a thing. You know, it has a certain cachet as a background for your ranger or whatever. But other than that, I don't know, maybe your D&D campaign is different from mine, but we've devoted very little time to hunting for pelts in my D&D campaign, and I play a character who lives in the woods and hunts for pelts. That's what I do when I'm not off having weird adventures, but I don't, like, stop in the middle of the game to go snare some rabbits. It's not a bad idea, but it's more of like a setting detail animal than a monster you're going to fight, and that's good because as a monster you're going to fight, it's very similar to a bunch of other ones. Plus, I love the illustration. It just looks offended, which it might well be since, you know, it's just minding its own business and then someone wants to come along and cut its skin off. Finally, we have The Hook Horror by Ian Livingstone. There's not really much to say about The Hook Horror, I don't think. The Hook Horror is a big, beaked, burly, underground creature with a chitinous exoskeleton and some big hooks for hands, and it runs around hooking people, and that makes clacking noises with its exoskeleton is kind of a fun detail, I guess. But other than that, it's just a big fight brute. It's sort of an inferior Umber Hulk. It's not terrific. It has the one fun detail that we've come to expect from an Ian Livingstone monster, but in general, not the level of, you know, thinking about its ecology or its role in a game. It's really just a fight monster. And it could easily be replaced with any number of other underground-dwelling fight monsters. But The Hook Horror got me thinking. So I've been looking through, as I've mentioned in the past, the old Fiend Factory column and the Fiend Factory miniatures line, and I'm not certain what the relationship between these things is, or if there is necessarily one relationship, because chronologically it seems to make sense that the monsters in the Fiend Factory column are based on the miniatures, just going off when the ad appeared. But there are one or two things that I'm not so sure about. But here's the thing. If we look at the Fiend Factory miniatures line and look at the monsters from there that made it into the Fiend Folio, the ones that aren't of generic fantasy monsters, there's FF71, the Gnome Assassin. That's clearly based on the Dark Creeper artwork, but it didn't come out until 1982 and postdates the Fiend Folio, and I suspect postdates the loss of the rights to TSR, which would mean that it would have to be called a Gnome Assassin because Games Workshop no longer owned the idea of the Dark Creeper. But the others are The Fiend. Now, The Fiend is a monster that kind of became the iconic image of the Fiend Factory column, but if you go back and look at its description, it's clearly the Forlaren. So clearly what ultimately became the Forlaren, and that was written by Ian Livingstone. Then you got The Hook Horror, Ian Livingstone. The Crabman, Ian Livingstone. The Phantom Stalker, that'd be Ian Livingstone. The Bloodworm, Giant, that's Ian Livingstone. The Carbuncle, that's by Albie Fiori. The Grell, that's Ian Livingstone. The Assassin Bug, Ian Livingstone. The Bone Snapper, Ian Livingstone. The Styx Devil, Ian Livingstone. And then there's a couple other ones. The Fire Newt, Albie Fiori. And the only one that doesn't seem to be by Ian Livingstone or Albie Fiori is the Death Dog. Oh, I take that back, actually. There's also the Necrophidius, which is called the Death Worm in its Fiend Factory release, and the Necrophidius, a.k.a. Death Worm, in the Fiend Factory column and the Vault. But the majority of the monsters that are in the Fiend Factory line and in the Fiend Folio book are ones that were written up either by Ian Livingston or Albie Fiori, which is to say, by people who worked for Games Workshop, well, worked for, in the case of Ian Livingston, owned Games Workshop. So those are ones that were written effectively in-house. So did they choose to make miniatures out of the monsters their people had written, you know, because of the rights, or did they have a bunch of models and then people already within the shop were given the job, or volunteered for the job, or whatever, of writing up stats for them? I don't know which way round it goes. I mention this for two reasons. The first is that being art-forward has always been a little bit more of a trend Games Workshop, and perhaps in British gaming in general. So if you think about something like someone, I don't remember who said this, it might have been David McGrogan, but it might not have been, said that Games Workshop has this thing where it's very art forward. So, like, if you think about servo skulls in the lore of Warhammer 40,000, they're these little robots made out of people's skulls that fly around and kind of assist certain types of characters. And they're creepy and gothic and sci-fi, and they embody the game's aesthetic well. There are rules for them in the game, but this didn't come from the rules for the game. John Blanche had been obsessively drawing flying skulls in the corners of things for a long time, and finally someone said, well, why don't we make a model of these and give them rules? And I wonder if that's what happened here, and if that maybe explains why the Hook horror is a little bit bland. You know, someone plonked an illustration or a model down in front of Ian Livingston or Albie Fiori and said, okay, here, you gotta make a monster out of this one. And sometimes you get the assassin bug, which is good, and sometimes Albie Fiori comes out with the carbuncle or the fire newt, which are good, and sometimes you get the Hook horror. You know, they can't all be winners. I genuinely don't know. If someone does know more about the production history here, I'd be interested to hear about it. Anyway, that's my thinking about the Hook horror. I think it may be that someone put this model down in front of Ian Livingston, and, you know, he did his best, and they're not all winners. I mean, nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong with having a big burly fight monster with one evocative detail. It's just not, doesn't stand out, necessarily. I did, in addition to finding out that the Fiend is the Forlaren, I did spot two other weird pieces of trivia. One, there's an entry in this book for Salaman that says, see Fire Newt, which is, there's a one sentence in the Fire Newt thing that says they are sometimes known as Salaman, and it's not relevant to anything. I can only assume that's because the miniatures were out and they were called Salaman before somebody decided to call them Fire Newts. And the other is, the Babbler is credited to someone called Jeremy Goodwin, and I can't remember if I asked this question, but is that Jez Goodwin, the miniature sculptor? I mean, it would make sense. Anyway, it's just, that's some trivia that I noticed while I was trying to figure out this thing about when monsters that also have miniatures were produced. Caring too much about miniatures in thinking about Dungeons & Dragons is definitely one of my things. Anyway, that's about it for today's episode. In the next episode, we're going to be finishing off the H section, so please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the Deities and Demigods Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.